It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Interesting bit of news coming out of Wisconsin. Evidently, in Wisconsin, they have figured it out. The brain trust there in the Republican-led state Senate, in the state of Wisconsin, where their motto is forward, have come up with a solution to take us backward again. They have figured out how to solve the labor shortage. They figured it out. No, it's not about increasing wages to draw more people in the jobs. No, it's not about making those jobs better. No, it's not about better working conditions, not better healthcare benefits. None of those things. It's not about creating good family-sustaining jobs, not about promoting ability of workers to join and form unions, none of that stuff. No. We're going to take those lazy kids and we're going to put them back to work. We tried the experiment. Some kids are just spoiled for work, getting a little too much education. See, that's a problem in this country. Got too many people who got themselves some education. Now they don't want to work. So what we do is we catch them early, make sure they don't get too smarty pants, and they get used to working hard, long hours, early. That's the key. Again, you know, you go back to the past when they were fighting against labor law reform that would have taken children out of mines. It was one of the things that the wealth class of this country was saying. If you give people too much education, they'll be spoiled for work. They'll think they're better than working. So we can't put kids into schools. Got to keep them in the mines. Well, what the Senate in Wisconsin has done, they've passed a piece of legislation that, like I said, has figured out how to solve the quote-unquote labor shortage, especially for small businesses. This is about putting those lazy kids back to work. Because last week, the state Senate there in Wisconsin approved a bill that will allow 14 and 15-year-olds to work until 11 p.m. Yep, that's what they're doing. Currently, Wisconsin, like many states, like all states across the country, they abide by the federal child labor laws that are in the Fair Labor Standards Act that allow children under 16 years of age to work from 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. from June 1st to Labor Day. You know, what they're considering the summer months when you don't have to get up the next morning and go to school. So saying, you know what? We're going to let 14 and 15-year-olds wake up at 7 o'clock, go do some work, and maybe they can work up until 9, maybe. I think that's a bit much, but okay. During the school year, it's changed. It's 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. because you want the kids to get a good night's sleep. They're younger. They need a little bit more sleep. That seems reasonable, but no, not in Wisconsin. No, in Wisconsin, what they want to do, what this legislation will do, is it will allow the kids to wake up and on school days. Get up at 6 a.m., get to work early, get a couple hours in before work, and then, you know, after school, maybe they can work all the way till 9:30. When school isn't the next day, 6 a.m. to 11 p.m. Now, their belief is this is how they're going to fund tourism and all of the small businesses because, you know, in their, you know, bless their hearts, they did put a cap. You can't make companies making over $500,000. We can't let, you know, the big corporations exploit children, just the little ones. Now, the bill would keep into place that these kids can only work 3 hours a day. And at least they've left that for now. 8 hours on non-school days for now. And 6 days a week. So 6 days a week, 3 hours a day. That's what they've come up with. The hotel and tourism people are all tingly in the panties. Happy, thrilled. In fact, you know, the Restaurant Association, very happy about it, except don't like some of the onerous regulations that come along with it. You know, like, you know, you can't have them using dangerous machines or running credit cards or things like that. Kind of young age, not a good thing. They're not thrilled. They want those kids, we need to put them to work. Obviously, the AFL-CIO in Wisconsin opposed to it, as am I. Now, look, I was somebody who, as a kid, I'm not against kids working. In fact, I wish we would bring some of those kid jobs back, like paper routes. Paper routes used to be for children. You had the paper boys in the corner. That's what they used to do. When I was 8 years old, I got my first paper route. I was delivering the Cleveland Press. It was an evening newspaper. I'd come home after school. I'd get my papers together. I'd go out. I'd deliver them after dinner. Made a couple of bucks. At 9 years old, I then got a Cleveland Plain Dealer route. Got up a little bit early before school. Went and delivered my newspapers. Came home. Did my homework. Had dinner. Went out and delivered the evening press. Not against that. Those are kid kind of jobs. But when you start talking about taking jobs that, well, adults should be doing, I got a problem with that. Because all you're really talking about doing is, hey, how can we lessen the working conditions? How can we exploit a workforce? And I'm against this. I'm against this in a pretty big way. But, you know, I think the trend is going to go that way. You see other states like Oregon, for instance, evidently lets 14-year-olds work at McDonald's. And there are other places around the country that do as well. Am I against kids working? No, I do have a problem with the times. This is what they're supposed to be doing at this age is getting a good education, the best education they can. Maybe learning a little responsibility, a little work ethic. Good at that. I'm happy with that. But this a bit too far. And the reality is, this is just an opportune moment for them to roll back some of the New Deal era protections that kept kids out of the workforce. I tell my kids all the time, you got one chance to get an education. You got one opportunity to be in this moment and to take advantage of this opportunity. Get the best education you can. Yeah, you know, work a little bit, save a little bit of money, do that stuff, understand what the job place is about. But this isn't your full-time existence, nor should it be. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out in Wisconsin, because if Wisconsin, whose motto is forward, ends up going backwards, how many other states are going to follow? I reached out to my state representative friend here in Pennsylvania, said, hey, anything like this on your docket? Not yet, is the response I got. So not yet. It is what it is. Now understand, you know, we're blaming the workers for this. You know, blame the workers, their fault. They're too lazy to work. Or they won't work for the poverty wages. And understand, we do that in every vein. Everything we do, it's about blaming the workers. Look at what we're doing in education. We don't have enough teachers. We don't have enough support staff. So blame them. Don't blame the conditions. Don't blame the idiocy of our policies to keep these workers safe. Because understand, most of the bus drivers that I know are retired women who, you know, it's a part-time job. It's always been that. And you've created an environment where you're not really doing everything you can do to keep those workplaces safe. I'll tell you, if I'm doing this as a part-time gig, need a little extra, what my grandmother used to call pin money, I'm not doing it. Not doing it. It's, again, a failure of leadership and policy. It's not to blame the workers. Now, over the weekend, saw Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Twitter, come out and claim and throw his hat into the ring that he believes hyperinflation is around the corner. And as I'm reading this story about Jack Dorsey, you know, saying, you know, hyperinflation is around the corner, because we know when hyperinflation comes, it's usually wartime. It's usually when, you know, a shock to the system happens, or you've got this massive supply chain gum up like we have right now. We've got really an unequal manufacturing world where most of the manufacturing that's done in this world is done in China and Asia. And the finished products are stuck on ships waiting to get in. So we're blaming truck drivers because there aren't enough of them. They're lazy. They don't want to work. So instead of, this is beautiful. So instead of saying, how do we make the conditions better for truck drivers who will want to come into the trucking industry and not continue to have an industry where people live in their trucks like animals, you know, basically sweatshops on wheels. How do we make the job enticing to want to draw people to it? Not what we're doing. What they're doing Here's the push. They're trying to get the age to get a CDL lowered from 21 down to 18. Now, let me ask you, think about your 18-year-old self. You really want an 18-year-old behind an 18-wheeler hauling 80,000 pounds down the road and telling them you can make as much money as you can while the wheels are turning? So as fast as you get to where you're going, you're going to make more money. Do you really want that scenario on your highway? The answer is no. At least I don't think it is. But, this is the direction that the trucking industry, the brain trusts, and the associations are pushing for. Got to lower that onerous age. You know, if you can join the military, you can drive a truck. And look, you know, there's a lot of argument. Say, maybe. It's 21 for a reason at this point. A lot of places that I remember wouldn't let you drive to are 23. And then you had to have, you know, years of experience. Now it's throw all of the safeguards and all of the rails off and barrel down the highway. Again, putting the responsibility onto those least able to shoulder it. And again, not doing the things that you need to do to make things better. So the argument is, well, we can't, you know, the supply chain's gummed up, so hyperinflation is coming. And this is what Jack Dorsey is saying. Now, as I'm reading through this, I'm thinking, okay, Jack, let me get this straight. You see hyperinflation coming. And now understand, I don't think inflation is a bad thing. I think a little bit of inflation, not too bad. Especially if wages keep up with the rate of inflation and you end up making a little bit more than the cost of goods rising, especially if you've got stronger unions to demand better wages, hours, and conditions, I think it's a good thing. You know, I go back to my grandparents who lived through the stagflation of the 70s, which made their mortgage payment that they took out in the 60s a joke. In fact, by the end of the 70s, the mortgage payment that my grandparents took out in the 60s was literally one day pay. One day's worth of pay was their monthly mortgage. So it helps debtors, and this is always the position. Depends on where you are and how inflation's going to affect you. If you're deep in debt, inflation's probably going to do pretty well for you because you took out money at a certain rate and a certain amount, and your wages are going to go up, and you're going to pay that debt off faster. If you're someone who has a lot of money and you're holding on to it, inflation probably not going to be your best friend, because you're not going to get. And as a country that is a debtor country, a little inflation might be a good thing, which is why I've been arguing that this obsession with holding inflation down, especially wage inflation, has really harmed the working class of this country. But we'll see if Jack's right. We'll see if hyperinflation is coming, not just for the U.S. He claims across the world this is coming. Now, the reason I bring this up is immediately my mind goes to everything that happens in this country gets blamed on working people. Everything that happens gets blamed on those who have the least power to deal with the situation. It's always, remember the housing crisis? It was all those people who took out mortgages they couldn't afford. It was the people's fault. It's workers' fault. It wasn't the banks who changed their philosophy of, hey, can they afford to buy this house? And have 20% down and be able, will we set them up for success? Or when they change to, hey, you know, in 5 years, when we repossess it from them, we'll have gotten all of our interest up front and then we get to sell it again to some other sucker who's going to pay us 5 more years of interest. It's a win-win-win. Except what happened is a whole bunch of people couldn't afford it and the whole thing collapsed because greed took over. But it was still those people's fault. I see this happening if Jack is right. If we do hit an era, a period of high inflation, I can see it coming. And mark it on your calendar that I said it today. This is going to turn around and be blamed on all of the striking workers who are demanding better wages, hours, and conditions. This is going to be put on all the people who marched out of jobs and said, no, we're not working in this service industry for crummy wages. We're not working without health security or retirement security. We demand better for ourselves and for our fellow workers. I guarantee you that the message would be, well, see, they got what they wanted. They wanted higher wages and they got higher wages. And it ends up costing you, the consumer, end up costing you more. I can see this coming. as clear as day, because this is their MO. Now, understand, higher wages will raise prices a little bit. But understand, for the last 45 years, the wealth class of this country has gotten away scot-free. They have lined their pockets enormously off the backs of working people. You've got 45 years of raises that didn't get into people's pockets. Now being demanded, people saying, look, we've worked for stagnant wages for way too long. We've worked for starvation wages way too long. Now is the time that you reward our work. You called us heroes and essential and all of those things during the pandemic. And now we demand to be treated as such. So, you know, I'm looking into my imaginary crystal ball and I'm going, if this happens, if we get inflation, it's all going to be blamed on the workers who are striking right now and those greedy unions. Because what the messengers at the top understand is it's so easy to divide the working class and to blame each other. So because we see each other. You know, I saw a guy the other day. The guy has a sweater on that says, you know, I work like crazy so the lazy can stay home. And I had to ask, I go, well, you know, which lazy are you talking about? Are you talking about the 745 billionaires who pocketed an additional $2.1 trillion during the pandemic? Well, no. Huh? How do you not think that you're supporting them? Because he doesn't see them. What he sees is the person who's struggling to get by, who has to use the EBT card at the supermarket. What he sees are people who are struggling to get by because the jobs that they're able to get are poverty wage jobs. So it's easy to point at them. And he's also pointed at them by every right-wing media outlet on this planet because it really is about dividing and conquering the working class. So when it comes to it, when we get to this moment, if we get some high inflation, you know who's going to be the blame. It's going to be those evil workers who had the audacity to think that they should be treated to reasonable wages, reasonable health care benefits, reasonable retirement security, and dignity. But that's just my thought. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe corporate America will say, no, our bad. We did this. Our greed and our obsession with more caused this crisis. Which side do you think is actually going to happen? Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Quick break, right back. Stick around. Still listen to The Rick Smith Show. There's nothing more American than workers standing up, and the union gives a voice to win. On The Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1886. That was the day Henry George accepted the nomination to run for mayor of New York on the United Labor Party ticket. In cities across the country, trade unionists met to found state labor parties and to hammer out political platforms for local and state elections. In New York City, ULP advocates issued the Clarendon Hall platform and nominated Henry George as the ULP candidate for the mayoral race. George had gained prominence with the 1879 publishing of his book, Progress and Poverty. In it, he addressed private land ownership as the basis for inequality and advocated for a single tax system. At New York's Cooper Union that evening, where thousands of supporters gathered, George addressed the crowd. He presented the ULP platform of higher wages, shorter hours, better working conditions, government ownership of railroads and communications, and the end to police repression. Burroughs and Wallace described the scene that night in their book, Gotham, A History of New York City, to 1898. During his speech, George declared, quote, "This government of New York City, our whole political system is rotten to the core." He argued that politicians had made a trade out of assembling votes and selling them to powerful interests. What business got in return was police protection, lax enforcement of housing and health codes, friendly judges, and fat franchises. To purify the political order, working class voters had to sever ties to all the established parties and choose from their own ranks. For a party that had just been founded weeks before, George came in second. But like its sister organization in Chicago, the New York ULP would split over issues of socialism within a year.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
So the month of October has been dubbed Striketober. And like I said last week, I'm hoping that this translates into never again November, something else for December. And this kind of energy and militancy continues into the coming months. Because, look, we desperately, desperately need it. We need the kind of activism we've been seeing. In fact, so many strikes right now. The number that I saw last week, there are more than 100,000 people who are either on strike or have authorized going on strike right now, which in my lifetime, I think that's probably the most I've seen in my lifetime, which, again, a good thing. In fact, this is so big that the AFL-CIO has dedicated a webpage to this. It's their big strike map. You can go across the country on this map and find in your backyard where there are strikes going on and where you can help participate. And it's AFLCIO.org/strike-map. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. But here to share some thoughts on this wave of strikes going on and maybe some details of the big ones, I've asked Dave Jamison to come talk with us. Dave is, in my view, the best labor reporter in the country. He's a labor reporter over at Huffington Post. Dave, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, thanks for having me. Thanks for the kind words.
So, you know, I'm looking at this strike map that the AFL-CIO has put out, and this is a pretty interesting moment. All this activity and in such a short period of time. I'd like to get your thoughts.
Yeah, something's definitely happening here. You know, with the caveat that the big numbers are strike authorizations, right? That doesn't necessarily mean everyone's going out on strike, but you know, say if there were a strike in Hollywood to come to pass, that's 60,000 workers right there. That would be the biggest private sector strike in 14 years. You've got over 30,000 who've authorized a strike at Kaiser, healthcare workers, and of course the 10,000 at John Deere. So the possibility of all these workers being on strike at once those are big numbers when you compare it to recent history. You know, over the past decade, a typical year in big work stoppages, we might see 150,000 out on strike, you know, in a given year on average. And I think that teacher strikes of 2018 and 2019, you know, have inflated that a bit. So if we had over 100,000 private sector workers on strike at once, that would be a really big deal. But of course, we got to put this in kind of the broader perspective of, you know, the long lens of history here. You go back to post-World War II years. We used to have 1 or 2 million workers out on strike in a typical year. So these, in the grand sweep of history, these are not big numbers. And that's a function of union density being way down. You know, you generally don't go out on strike if you don't have a union. It requires a strike fund, organization, everything that unions do. So in the grand sweep of things, these are low numbers, as we've seen for years, but kind of in more recent history, you know, something's popping here. And I think a lot of it has to do with the leverage workers are seeing. You know, there's kind of a weirdly tight labor market in a lot of places. There were very few strikes last year during the pandemic. A lot of, you know, bargaining was put off because of the pandemic. And I think now, you know, workers are coming out of that and they're flexing their muscles a bit.
Yeah, and also, you know, the thing that I keep hearing overwhelmingly from the people who have been going on strike, you know, all during the pandemic, we were called heroes and essential and patted on the back and say how wonderful we were. And now we're being treated like garbage. And, you know, they kind of got used to being respected. They kind of got used to having a little dignity. And now they're demanding that their pay, their compensation, and their working conditions meet that. And I think this is a great moment. But to your point about, you know, just what we're seeing in the small number of folks who have unions, I think the other side of this is happening as well with the Great Resignation. As you're seeing all these people just going, I don't have the right to strike, but I have the right to leave. And I think that's the reason you're not seeing people coming back to some industries, especially in the low-wage service sector.
Absolutely. I think you're totally right. You know, what we're seeing in the non-union world of high rates of quits, high rates of people staying out of the workforce, millions of people, because for one reason or another, they don't like what employers are offering. So I've called it kind of a silent strike, you know, where this is not workers going out on a picket line, walking off the job. This is workers just saying, you know what, I don't like what you're offering, so I'm not going to work. And I think For the non-union workers doing that, I think it's you know, for a lot of the same reasons as the union workers, you know, at John Deere and elsewhere, who have gone out on strike, is they don't like what the employer is offering, so they're holding out for something better.
Yeah, and this to me is one of these moments, Dave, where you go, it's apparent we need major comprehensive labor law reform, because you have so many people quitting. Instead of saying, no, we're going to stand and we're going to fight and we're going to make things better. Because, look, I grew up in a generation where, you know, if something was wrong in the workplace, we believed that we could change it. We believed we could organize. Look, I'm a lot older than what's going on now. But I remember a time where we thought, you know, at least we'd have a fair shot at organizing. I think right now, I think the majority of workers in this country know that the chances of organizing and winning an election and getting a contract are so much. More difficult than they were in years past, which is why, one, I think we need the labor law reform. But two, do you think this is a possibility of a moment where employers finally wake up and go, well, maybe you should make it a little bit easier because we can't get anybody to come into these crummy jobs?
Yeah, you know, I think an interesting thing, you know, is going on here where we have this tight labor market that is giving workers leverage. But as I keep telling people, I think a lot of people in unions and a lot of people on the left are excited about what's going on right now. But this could be really fleeting, you know, at the end of the day, if this is really just a function of what's going on in the job market. You know, that could be a temporary shift of leverage towards workers and not something systemic, you know. This isn't necessarily what we're seeing, something that is going to put more workers into unions and give them the ability to wield the strike weapon, right? I think, you know, you'd be looking for something more, some more systemic change with something like the PRO Act or pieces of the PRO Act that end up going into law that make it easier to join unions, make it a lot easier to win first contracts. You know, that's the kind of potentially permanent shift in power we might see. You know, short of that, you know, maybe this labor market changes and a lot of that leverage evaporates. And you know, in 5 years, we're looking at a total reversal of the tables here. You know, we just don't know.
No, and that's the sad thing, because I keep telling people, like, I have some friends who are bus drivers, and they say, well, you know, they're throwing better wages, everything's great right now. I go, this is the reason you need a union right now, to make sure you get that in writing, because just what you're saying, in a year, two, three, five, when things go back to the way it used to be or what was normal then, they just claw all that stuff back and you're no better off. So right now is that time. We're with Dave Jamieson. Dave is a labor reporter over at Huffington Post. You can check out the work that he does over at HuffingtonPost.com. Dave, let's talk about some of the work that you've been doing around the John Deere strike, around what's going on with IATSE and this tentative agreement. But let's start with John Deere. 10,000 workers out on strike. Tell me what's going on.
So the Deere strike is a really fascinating story for a couple reasons. One being that this isn't just a repudiation of John Deere. It's frankly a repudiation to the United Auto Workers, who bargained a tentative agreement. They took it to membership. They thought it was a satisfactory deal. The Deere workers voted it down overwhelmingly. 90% said no, go back to the table. And that's how we ended up, you know, having this very large strike. And, you know, having talked to workers, they feel like they've really got the short end of the stick on the last few contracts. A big piece of why this rejected was they have a two-tier system at John Deere. You know, this was created in 1997, where new hires thereafter would be getting you know, lesser pay and benefits. They've closed the gap on the pay. The lower benefits are still there. The workers want to eliminate that. Deere wanted not only to keep that system in place, but to essentially expand it, create a third tier for new hires who wouldn't get any defined benefit pension at all. So, you know, the workers I talked to said, we're tired of this kind of them dividing us. You know, we want equal pay for equal work. We don't want to be, you know, siloed into these different classes that resent each other, right? And the workers now know if we sell out the workers who come after us, they're not, why would they look out for us, you know, when the time comes and contract talks? And so this is like the two-tier thing. We've been seeing this for years, Rick. You know it, you know, really well. I think it's coming to a head now. We see it at Kellogg's too. The fight there is largely about a two-tier system. Kaiser, same thing. Strike authorization in large part because of a two-tier proposal. I think workers are tired of the divisions, and a lot of them are recognizing that it essentially threatens the union itself over the long term by the way that it sows division. What's going on there is interesting, because the members have told, both Deere and the UAW, we're tired of the system. We're taking control here and we want to change it.
No, and look, this is, unions are our workplace democracy, and this is what an active membership is all about. Something that I talk about all the time, which what I think it's important, if you're a member, be an active member, be engaged. When things come this way, vote it down. But here's the thing. I remember those two-tier systems coming out back in the 90s and people on the job going, screw the unborn. We're going to get what we get now. And I remember back then saying, you're creating a division within your union, and this is going to rip you apart. And we're right where I think virtually most, I think every working person was like, this is a bad idea. I talked to a guy from Kellogg, and he said that it's such a big gap between what one group makes and the other. It's like $12 an hour.
It is.
And they can't keep people coming in. Their turnover rate is incredibly high. So what ends up happening is you can't keep people. So the legacy, the people who have been there a while, end up getting abused with massive forced overtime and all kinds of things. And this is where we are, which is why you would think that the company would go, hey, maybe we do need to close that system.
Yeah, I think that's right. And the folks at Kellogg's, and we've heard of that, we heard it at Nabisco too. Workers saying that their companies are having a hard time retaining people. And we hear it at John Deere too. I was talking to someone at the Waterloo plant who said that, he feels like they're only hanging on to half of the new hires that they've brought on recently. Because those folks are getting lesser benefits than people used to. And on top of that, you got kind of a tighter labor market where employers don't necessarily have the pick of the litter. They say at Deere, they used to be able to just, interview 100 people and pick whoever they wanted. That is not how it is right now. And so, that at Deere combined with the high ag commodity prices, Deere is extremely profitable. It's a great time to be selling farm equipment. The workers sense that as a couple told me, like, it's now or never.
Yeah.
Like, these are the best conditions we're going to get to go on strike. So let's do it now.
Yeah, no, so where do you see this going in the coming days? I mean, like you said, now is the time Deere should be selling all of the tractors they can. I can't imagine that they're overly happy having their workforce out. This is the time for them to negotiate and end this quickly, because ultimately this is about John Deere ending this strike.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, I never like place bets on when a strike is going to end, because I feel like I'm always wrong.
Yeah.
Deere put out a statement yesterday, the day before, saying they feel like progress has been made in talks. And this is, obviously going to be really painful for them, however long it drags out. And if you're a worker, getting $250 a week or whatever, from the strike fund, it does not compare with what you normally get. So I think everyone wants to wrap this up. But the workers I've talked to are thinking this could go on a long time. Yeah. I mean, I talked to one guy who, refinanced on his car loan, and is just ready to dig in, and is convinced that Deere is going to come back with essentially the same proposal. So, people there are ready for a fight. And like a lot of strikes, you talk to people who say, I wanted to go on strike 5 years ago. This is something that people have been kind of mentally preparing for a long time. And so I think a lot of people are ready to hold the line for as long as they think they need to.
Yeah, and hopefully they financially prepared. As an old timer told me, day one in a union job, he said, before you get used to spending all the money you're going to make, put 6 months of your bills in a coffee can and forget you have it. Because you may have to walk across that on that picket line, and you better not be hungry. Because it could go 6 months, it could go longer. So you got to be prepared to fight and defend what we've got here. And he was not wrong. Let's move over to the IATSE tentative agreement. Because initially I looked at it and going, there's some things I'm not thrilled with, but they got something better than what they were offered. We're now hearing some grumblings from the membership that, no, they're not really interested in this at all. Tell me a little bit about it.
Yeah, it's this is with the caveat that there are no polls on this sort of thing. I don't pretend to know how this ratification vote will go. I have talked to people who have pretty serious concerns about it. you know, people wanted strong turnarounds, right? This is an industry term for the amount of time you're guaranteed between your shift ending and when you have to be back the next day. You know, the union in the tentative agreement got guaranteed 10-hour turnarounds. A lot of members already have that. They wanted something stronger, you know, on the order of 12 hours. And there's also this issue of residuals from streaming content, right? Streaming is blown up. It's the huge part of where the studios make their money. You know, there's traditionally been lower pay and residuals on that stuff. The proposal does pull the wages up, but you know, people are concerned that the residual piece is not being addressed satisfactorily to keep the health and pension funds in good shape. So the residuals are a big piece of this too. And then you had this horrific, you know, tragedy where the cinematographer got shot and killed on set the other day in that Alec Baldwin film. And for a lot of people, I think that sort of brings home the safety and workplace, you know, and working conditions aspect that they've been talking about here. It's been reported that some of those workers walked off the set that morning before this happened. Over their pay being held up and them, you know, having safety concerns. So there's a lot of variables and a lot of wild cards here. And it's amazing to see so many people really in tune with the process. I mean, I've talked with a lot of workers who are never kind of this closely attuned to what their union was doing. So I think there's, like, again, a big kind of democratic moment here of people being, you know, really engaged, and that over the long term is going to be a good thing. We'll see if this is bumpy, you know, and what happens with this tentative contract. Maybe it gets, you know, approved on strong numbers. Maybe it gets voted down and they send the union back to the table, and then things could get kind of hairy. So we don't know how this is going to go, but this is, like, very far from over.
Yeah, I mean, because like I said, I saw the tentative agreement and I'm like, yeah, they won some things. I would have, in this moment, you know, being the historic nature of the vote to authorize a strike, and the sheer number of people participated, I thought that maybe they got a little bit better, but we'll see. We'll see how this vote plays out. Dave, I appreciate the time. As always, great stuff. Keep up the great work there at Huffington Post, and I hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
Always great talking to you, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much, our good friend Dave Jamieson. Make sure you check out his work over at Huffington Post, huffingtonpost.com, the website. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1990. That was the day that 8 of the 10 unions at the New York Daily News went out on strike. The paper had one of the highest daily circulations in the United States. The New York Daily News was owned by the Chicago-based Tribune Company. The strike began when management demanded major concessions from the delivery drivers, essentially forcing them out on strike. 7 more unions joined them on the picket line. In retaliation, management brought in scab labor. This caused the 9th union to join the walkout. The Newspaper Guild workers had planned to honor the picket lines, but not go on strike themselves. But according to an article in the Los Angeles Times, quote, said local guild president Barry Lipton, the editorial employees decided almost immediately at an afternoon meeting to go on strike rather than to work with any imported scabs and goons. Well-known journalist Juan Gonzalez was a strike leader for the local. By using replacement workers, Daily News management was able to keep the paper in production, but they found it much more difficult to get the paper distributed. Even where they could make delivery, many newsstands refused to sell the struck paper. The New York Times blamed this on intimidation from the delivery drivers. But they also acknowledged that some refused distribution either out of sympathy for strikers or an unwillingness to offend pro-union customers. To support the strike, the unions put on a concert headlined by Lou Reed, along with Pete Seeger, Q-Tip from A Tribe Called Quest, and other musicians. The strike lasted for 5 months, prompting the Tribune to sell the paper. Under new management, the strike was finally settled.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
as I said at the beginning, one of the things that we do in this country, and we do it quite well, is we blame the people least able to do anything about what they're being blamed for. Like I said, I fully expect if inflation happens, we're certainly going to blame the workers who demanded better wages, hours, and conditions. That, you don't need to be a rocket science, a genius, an economist. You don't need to be even halfway bright to figure that one out because we know it's coming. Same thing with teachers. We keep hearing there's a teacher shortage. There's a shortage of bus drivers, lunch ladies. There's a shortage of all these things. So who do we blame? We blame the lunch lady. We blame the bus driver. We blame the teacher. Not a system that has created this mess. Not a system that we patchwork part-time people into fill different roles. No. We blame the people who are least able to actually have any effect on it. I'm here to share some thoughts on what's going on in our school system. I've asked Sari Beth Rosenberg to come talk with us. Sari Beth is the Senior Education Advisor for Voters of Tomorrow. She's also an educator. Sari, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So I'm looking at this moment, and you're going to have to turn your computer down.
Okay.
I'm looking at this moment, and I'm going, you know, the people who are least able to afford the change, the people who are least responsible for it, those are the folks we're blaming.
Absolutely. It's always the case.
So what can we do about it?
Well, I think for one, we need to, you know, I feel like I'm saying this over and over again. We need to pay teachers more.
That was quick.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. That was quick. That was, yeah. There it is. Pay. There's the answer.
We're done. I was like, can the world hear me? We need to pay teachers more. We need to pay bus drivers more. We need to pay paraprofessionals more, school staff more. I mean, we've been saying this for how many decades, Rick? I mean, for a long, long time, right? Now, the one thing is that I was doing a little deep dive into, you know, last year I was talking to a lot of people in the field, and they were predicting that there was going to be a turnover rate of teachers, school staff, like we've never seen. And we haven't, the numbers are still in. So there's the, you know, there's the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics. They don't really have enough information and data to let us know if that's happened yet. But looking at places like, you know, Clark County, Nevada, and Austin, Texas, there is a turnover. We see that. But they haven't really been able to figure it out for the whole country. But one of the reasons maybe why not as many teachers left the profession is that we have a very unstable economy right now. And teaching might not pay that well, but it is a state in states, especially with labor unions. And once you get tenure, your job is protected.
Right.
So that might explain why we're not seeing that turnover rate. But let me tell you, I'm on the front lines here, and teachers are always burnt out because of, you know, we love the job so much, we overwork ourselves outside of the job and all the demands in school. But this year, I've never seen the burnout and just the feelings of, you know, just feeling like we can't keep up. So yeah. I'm concerned about that.
No, it's the same thing that I fear about nurses.
Yep. Oh, God. Even more so for nurses. They've been dealing with this for over almost 2 years now.
So now that you're back in the classroom, you know, walk me through what your day looks like.
Well, every day. So I'm
turning your computer volume off.
Okay.
You know, so what does your day look like?
So basically, you know, what's going on is that I essentially, every morning, I'm in the New York City public school system. We do a screening. And then we, you know, put your mask on and your mask's on all day. Now, luckily, all the students are complying, wearing their masks. The staff's wearing their masks. So my day, I'm teaching during a pandemic, but I feel pretty safe in terms of that. Is there social distancing? Absolutely not. I mean, we're in New York City public school, a high school in New York City, overpacked. It's not the fault of the DOE or my principal or anyone. It's just, we're serving a lot of kids and they need us. But so far we've been okay. I think we have a really good vaccination rate. That's promising. But sometimes I forget I'm teaching during a pandemic because you just kind of adapt. That's human nature.
Right.
But I have moments at the end of the day where, let me tell you, teaching through a mask all day, you get really dehydrated. But I'd rather do that than, you know, spread and get COVID.
Yeah, and or go back to a system of where you're having to do what you did last year, which, you know, nobody was happy with. So I think,
absolutely,
you know, you're trying to do the best you can given the scenario that you got in front of you.
Yeah, exactly. And so anytime that I'm like, oh, this mask sucks, I'm like, you know what sucks more? Talking to a blank screen of avatars. So, and I will say, in terms of the young people that I'm teaching, they're still adjusting, and I see the effects of on them. It's that we definitely need. I know there's been a lot of funding to the schools now with Biden's plan, but I will say that I think every school system across the country, if they think that they have enough mental health professionals, they don't. These kids need that just as much as they need to, you know, learn the content they've missed and get the skills back.
Now, let me ask you this as an educator. Are you concerned that over the last year and a half that kids don't catch up, that they end up through their education careers, you know, being a little bit back? Because, you know, I, as a parent, I'm concerned because I feel that the kids lost, you know, a good portion of a year. And that, you know, there's part of me goes, maybe we should, you know, have a stop and go, you know what, we're gonna throw an extra year on here, just to get caught up. Or are my concerns too outdated?
You know, I was trying to be optimistic this summer, and I was getting really frustrated with everyone calling it the lost year, or whatever. Now that I'm back in the classroom, you're not being hyperbolic by suggesting that. And also in terms of their social emotional growth, their socializing skills, knowing how to problem solve in the classroom with other kids. And I will say that one thing that is really on my mind lately is that not only are the kids miss out on in-person learning and those skills you get, just writing down notes and writing essays, these testing companies are very excited to start testing them again. And in New York State, we have a Regents exams, and I think they're acting like things are normal. And they're not. And the kids are really stressed out. And want to know what stresses them the most? Standardized tests. And we're throwing that on their plate this year of all years.
That's a great idea. Yeah, if they haven't dealt with enough already, let's browbeat them with a test that nothing to help them. And this is my problem. We've opted our kids out of all of the standardized tests all of their years simply because it doesn't help them. You know, I'm and as I explained to them, I'm not against testing. I'm a big fan of testing. We should be testing you every week so we know what you know, and then next week we pick up and figure out how to get you to know what you don't know. But these tests you take in, what, March, April? You don't get the results to November? No.
No, in New York, they take them at the end of June, like the last week of school, and they never see their test, the actual test booklets. They just see the score. So these are program-based assessments. They're not designed to help the kids. I mean, the data is used to track growth and all that stuff, but if it was really for the kids, they'd be giving these tests earlier than June and giving them the test booklet back. Same with College Board. Kids take these don't get me started about that. That's a whole other segment. The kids take the College Board exams. They don't even see anything.
I'm not so against the idea of College Boards just to find out where you are, to place you in the right course. Maybe you do need to take a 100-level remedial course to get caught up, because we don't want people set up for failure. But I'm looking at these tests.
No.
There's nothing with these standardized tests going through K through 12 that I see of any benefit for the student whatsoever.
Yeah, they're ridiculous. In terms of College Board, I'm just saying, in terms of, like, you know, I sometimes wonder if we should just for SATs, that's a different discussion. But the kids aren't guaranteed the college credit if they're taking the College Board classes. A lot of colleges are not even accepting AP exams now. So that's another beast. But I agree, these K-12 standardized tests, I just don't understand the point of them anymore, especially right now.
I never understood the point of them. But But here, we're in this moment, though, Sari, where education is under attack from all directions. You've got, you know, these right-wing idiots who are organizing around taking over school boards because they'll be damned if their kid's going to wear a mask because they want to see their beautiful smiles.
The pretty face. Yeah. Depriving us of it.
Have you experienced some of this craziness in your day?
You know, I haven't, because I keep, you know, New York City doesn't have, you know, we have our drawbacks, that's for sure. But in terms of compliance with COVID safety, at least in, I'm in a school in Midtown Manhattan, but kids are coming from all across the country. And the one thing that warms my heart, and it's, I'm pretty stressed lately, but seeing the fact that all the kids have their masks on, and sometimes they slip because that just happens, you know, you're talking or something. And I've never had a kid get upset when I tell them to pull the mask up. And, you know, kids were used to having snacks in class. They're not doing that anymore. And they're getting vaccinated. So some kids I'm hearing, not necessarily in my school, but across the country, they're trying to sneak the vaccine because their parents won't let them get it. I find that young people are much more compliant, and because they don't want to be home learning again. They want to do everything they can to get back in the classroom and stay safe.
How screwy is that? I mean,
right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. But I guess it's the world that we now live in. You know, it's this weird, bizarre, everything is hyper-political. I mean, you know, I found it amazing as you were listening to some of these people at these school boards talking about vaccines. Like, this is some rare thing that never happens. And yet, you know, all of their kids to get into school have had a series of vaccines that they never questioned before. But now this one that's popped up. Yeah. And look, I don't think that it would be any, I think it would be different on the other side had Trump won re-election. I think there would be people on the left going, I don't trust the Trump vaccine. I think it would be the kind of the same thing, but it's bizarre that we're in this place.
We are, you know, it's funny you say that because before Trump lost so many times, right? I did, you know, did a little poll of my friends, are you going to get the vaccine? And I'm not going to lie. I heard some language like, I don't know if I trust it. And I was all in. I'm like, shoot me up as many times as you need to. I want to get back in the classroom. I want to get back to my life. I want to see my family again safely. But I definitely heard the hesitancy. But I still like to think that everyone would have gotten vaccinated if they had to, and they would have been like pulling these hissy fits on planes and trains and not automobiles. They don't have to get vaccinated. They don't have to wear a mask to get on in their automobile. But it's crazy, you know. The young people, I don't see them freaking out. They're not freaking out about learning about racism. They're not freaking out about getting a shot or wearing a mask. And that's because they're somewhat shielded from the talk radio they're listening to and the Fox News and whatever is getting into their brains about the politics behind the science.
Yeah, they're not on Facebook.
No, right. It's really, I know, right? They are on Instagram and TikTok, but they're not in that algorithm, I guess, yet.
Yet. I guess that's the important part. It's yet. You know, they're still talking about, you know, I saw the dumbest thing I've ever seen. Now, look, I've seen some really dumb things on TikTok and some of these different challenges, like eating a spoon of cinnamon. Or the one idiot who, I guess a bunch of them sprayed rubbing alcohol on themselves and set themselves on fire. But this latest one where you're pulling your hair out or popping your skull or whatever the heck it is, it's crazy.
I don't know. Well, there was also, I thought you were going to say the one where this went on for like a week only, I think. And I luckily I wasn't the recipient of this. But there was like a slap a teacher challenge or something. And then a week before that, it was like stealing random stuff from the school. I was like, these kids are really forgetting how to be at school. Like, no, you're not. You really want to steal like a random toilet seat cover? It was really bizarre. So
yeah, they're going to hang it above their bed.
Yeah, I made it back to school. Check it out. Look what I got. My prize. Ridiculous.
Absolutely crazy. Lastly, on this teacher shortage thing and on the educator shortage, are you seeing it? Are you seeing the shortage? And if there is one, what can be done to deal with this? Because, look, I know there are a lot of places they've got a shortage of bus drivers, a shortage of cafeteria workers, things like that. Thoughts on how we address that?
Well, okay. So I think one way you address it, like I started off the segment, pay teachers more, pay bus drivers more, pay school staff more. And it seems difficult, but it sounds like it's difficult, but it's actually not. Also, the less we have schools shutting down where people feel like, I don't know if I can go to work every day. My son's school might shut down, so then I can't go to work. You see a lot of that happening in the job market. That's why some people are opting to stay home and not go back into the workplace full time because they're concerned that there's going to be a school shutdown. So when it's time to vaccinate your kid. Wear masks, like support that even in states where they're trying to penalize you for following COVID safety so we can keep the schools open and therefore make people who normally used to work at schools feel like they can steadily go back to work. And then another thing is just like increase and just like, I also think that we need to work on I know we're talking a lot about the social and emotional health of the young people, and that's very important, but I think there needs to be more funding for mental health services for teachers. I know that in some states, teachers' health insurance doesn't necessarily cover enough mental health practitioners in their areas. And I think maybe like push into schools for teachers to have someone to talk to. I'm seeing a lot of people, you know, we have to remember that teachers are people too. They've lost family members. They've had really sick family. They've had sick family members and friends. And now they're being pushed back into a classroom with like double, triple the work to catch up. And there isn't really a place for them to turn. So if you want to support healthy, safe schools for kids, you need to create healthy and safe environments for teachers. So let's put some funding into that.
Maybe a guidance counselor for teachers.
No, you know, honestly, there's been times where I've spoken to our counselor, you know, talking about what's going on with a student, and then I find myself talking about what's going on with me, because it's not the worst idea. Why not?
Yeah, I mean, but here's the problem. I know a lot of school districts don't even have guidance counselors for the students, let alone for the teachers. And again, this comes back to funding and all of the things that have happened over the last 30 years and the attacks on education. And we're in this moment after the pandemic where all of those attacks and all of those, you know, the death of 1,000 paper cuts are finally coming to light. You know, with everything in our society, this pandemic has really highlighted a lot of the fissures and a lot of the strains on all of our systems. And the question is, where are we going to pick up and move from this point forward?
Right, and I'm getting a little nervous now because we the mantra was like let's not go back to normal. Wasn't working.
Normal sucked.
And we are at a
you're
normal
right.
Sucked. We all hated normal, but we're at a precipice now, Rick. And I really hope that we stay on that track because
there you go.
I'm getting a little nervous.
Right there, you know? Sari. I appreciate the time as always. Good stuff.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Rick.
Our good stuff is friend Sari Beth Rosenberg. She's a senior education advisor for Voters of Tomorrow. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2002. That was the day that working people of the United States lost one of their greatest champions in Washington. Two-term Minnesota Senator Paul Wellstone died tragically in a plane crash. The crash took place just 11 days before Election Day. Wellstone was running for his third term in office. His wife, daughter, three aides, and two pilots also died in the crash. Wellstone was known for fighting for those who didn't have a voice in the halls of power. The poor, the workers, the farmers, the seniors. He once famously said, "I'm here to represent the little fellers, not the Rockefellers." The most impactful legislation the senator passed was the Paul Wellstone Mental Health and Addiction Equality Act of 2007. It required insurance providers to treat mental health at the same level that they would provide for physical health care. When he died, the United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers of America remembered Wellstone as the strongest voice for America's working families in the United States Senate. AFSCME Local 34 wrote, "He was the best friend that AFSCME had in the U.S. Senate, and supported us and the issues that affected working families." At a 10-year commemoration of his death, Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton called Wellstone the conscience of the Senate. In January, the AFL-CIO established the Wellstone Award. The award honors elected leaders who take a strong stand for workers' freedom to come together in unions and who fight for social and economic justice. Wellstone once said, "Politics is not about power. Politics is not about money. Politics is not about winning for the sake of winning. Politics is about the improvement of people's lives." We could sure use more senators like Paul Wellstone today. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.